Ladies and gentlemen, we, people of color, daughters and sons of immigrants, we belong to Europe. I am, we are the story of Europe. Hello everybody and welcome to this new episode of We Belong, the podcast that gives a voice to the new daughters of Europe. Today we're traveling to the United Kingdom to hear the story of a strong and powerful woman who has worked to counter violent extremism. She has also been recognized by the United Nations former Secretary General Kofi Annan and by the former President of the United States Barack Obama. Her name is Fatima Zeman and I'm happy to introduce her to you. Hello Fatima.
Hello Yasmin, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm very excited to be chatting to you.
And thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. It's my honor. You know, we met 2 years ago, I think, in New York for the General Assembly of the UN. And I was looking forward to meeting you since a long time. So it's such a pleasure to be in touch and to discuss together today.
No, the pleasure is all mine. You are a powerful and strong and inspirational woman in your own right. So I'm happy to support.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So let's start with a classical question that you ask to every guest, which is for every episode, we want to define our guests with a keyword that represents them or that represent their work. So what is your word for us today?
My word, it has to be activist. And as we talk more, I can unpack that. But if you ask me who I am or how I identify, I tell you that I'm an activist.
Okay, amazing. Activist. And I will just let you explain it more in a few, because I think that your work and your story is much related to activism. Actually, at the age of 13, if I am right, you witnessed a terrorist attack in your own city.
Yes, that's correct. It was 7th July 2005, and the UK and London had experienced the most devastating terrorist attacks to take place, certainly in my lifetime. It was, for want of a better word, the 9/11 for the UK. And as a Muslim woman in Britain of Bangladeshi heritage, you immediately call into question your identity, particularly because your faith is being accused as being the perpetrator of that attack, or those purporting to be Muslims. For me, that was unacceptable because I know my faith and I know that's absolutely not what we stand for. But more importantly, I felt a sense of loss in two ways. One was for the loss of life that this violent attack had on my community. In the UK, the attack on my hometown in London, and the loss of life for those who were injured and passed because four idiots decided to blow themselves up. And the second type of loss I felt was that I was losing something right now in that moment that I would only find out what it was many years later. And that was the loss of my freedom to be myself. The Islamophobia and the xenophobia and the racism that followed those attacks have had a lasting impact on my life. And so at the age of 13, I decided to become an activist because I was acutely aware of what was happening. I was very concerned for the future and I had a choice to make. I could either sit there and become an extremist apologist for those who had hijacked my faith and my identity, or I could become an activist. I could work to promote peace, inclusivity, and help build the community back to its former way. You know, before the attacks, neighbors had their doors open and we would welcome one another. And suddenly the doors closed, shut, shut, shut. And it was, well, you're a Muslim, you can't be trusted. So that's my journey towards becoming an activist. And it made me realize that actually, the only thing that I could be doing with my life is working to counter violent extremism so that no other young woman experiences what I did. No one has to feel their identity being torn apart and ultimately, in fitting with your series, we feel like we belong.
Definitely. Yes, and I think that, you know, 2005 was really a moment for you that changed your life. It defined who, what you would do of your life and also who you would be, because you're explaining this, you know, we can maybe say an identity crisis, being British, Bengali, Muslim, having different identities. When do you think you made peace with your identities and understood that you can be all these, you know, all these together?
So you're absolutely right. It was a turning point. And like most teenagers, you think I was concerned with makeup and handbags and shoes. My concern was world peace and community and everyone coming together and the absence of violence or preventing further violence. And so I was odd and different in that sense. And it shook me. And the threat of insecurity was something that has stayed with me, and I carried a lot of vicarious trauma. And I'm so glad you ask when I was at peace or found peace with my identity. It wasn't for a long time, until perhaps adulthood. I will say when Kofi Annan called me to service, and I was 23 then, to become one of his youngest advisors to work on countering violent extremism, that's when I realized it's okay to be a hybrid. You can be different and still be brilliant. I was moving towards that, and the support that I got from friends and family was really helpful. But that's when I realized actually these white supremacists or these racists or these Islamophobes cannot put me down. I will say that I'm never fully comfortable in your identity, because it's always changing. So I'm at the point in my life where I'm comfortable with saying what I want. I'm comfortable with putting to rest the trauma that I have carried for the last 10 to 13 years, but I'm by no means I'm comfortable with the existing you know, unconscious biases and unconscious racism that I face. And I'm so glad that we're having this chat today, because it's absolutely necessary for me to be able to talk to someone who understands it. And I know, Yasmin, you yourself are a hybrid in your identities, and there's a familiarity in our stories, or there's a familiarity to my sharing my story and another young woman who'll be listening to this. That's what I want to convey.
Especially because, I mean, it was only 10 years later, 2015, when I witnessed, you know, the terrorist attacks in Paris. Not directly, I wasn't there, fortunately, but I faced all that discrimination and, you know, the view, the perception of people like being afraid of you, that you might have witnessed also in the UK. So I totally understand when you were, you know, looking for yourself and trying to fit in a society that just sees you as a problem, right?
Completely. Especially when you haven't done anything wrong and you have so much to offer. And one thing I should mention, all of these feelings were not unique to myself. I know others were feeling it, and I know others felt it so strongly that they became radicalized. But for me, it was especially unique because it was compounded by the fact that my family migrated to the UK in search of a better life. And to be affronted with the racism and the xenophobia was surprising. It was challenging, but I grew up thinking that my parents had weathered that storm for me. Never did I think, being born in the UK, that that's something that I would experience myself. And we, you know, I grew up in the poorest borough in the UK. So ultimately, I'm meant to be a statistic. I'm meant to be a failure, and I'm meant to not have a voice. I'm meant to be just another person who goes through the system. And if I'm lucky, the system doesn't fail me. Knowing all of that, and knowing that by the virtue of my birth and by the virtue of my postcode or zip code and my skin color and my gender and my religion, I was buried under a, you know, not even a glass ceiling, a lead wall, before I could even think about rising up to become an activist. And so all of the inequalities that I faced, they were structural. They were placed there before I even knew that they were inequalities. And then to have such a significant moment in your life, or a significant time in your life, be turned by a terrorist attack, it makes you realize I absolutely have to live my life in a way that contributes to society. Civic contribution or civic or public service is what I am completely about. And I would encourage everyone to consider public service, especially in this time. You know, being an activist, it's not about being selfish. It's you always put the cause first, no matter what it is. For me, that's about making sure there is a peaceful world. But it could be about climate change. It could be, you know, LGBTQ rights. It could be about making sure women's rights and gender equality is at the forefront of every agenda of every national government. So for me, public service is what it's all about. That's my vision for the world, and I hope some of your listeners will join me.
I hope so. At least you convinced me. You convinced me, but you're talking about intersectionality, about your different elements that shaped you. And you know, when you mention the fact that normally a person like you is just a statistic mentioned on the media, you know, there is this author and activist from France, Rokhaya Diallo. She often says that she is a sociologic accident, which is, you know, and she even wrote this book called Don't Stay at Your Place, like, you know, dare to be, to go outside where they want to fit you, because that's precisely what you did. And also what I find interesting, because I didn't mention it, but you were precisely in a school very near to the terrorist attack that occurred. And because of that, right, you also show that the victims are also Muslim. It's not just about Muslims against non-Muslim. It's also, we are the first and foremost attacked in our values and in our also community, right?
You're absolutely right, Yasmin. And what I should say, and that's why I said I felt loss in two ways. I felt loss because I was grieving for everyone who had passed, even though they were strangers, but they were part of my community. And lost because I knew the other community that I belonged to would come under scrutiny in the coming years, both in terms of from the media, attacks from the empowered racists and white supremacists, attacks in terms of legislation about tougher legislation on brown and minority ethnic communities. Let's not be politically correct about this. Let's call bullshit for what it is. Excuse my French. We were under scrutiny and we still are. Every time I go through an airport, I'm always the one being stopped. I'm always the one being pulled aside. I'm always the one having to take my shoes off and take my belt off and explain why I am traveling when nobody else has to. That scars you. That type of criminality without any good reason frustrates me, and deeply frustrated me then as it still does now. And we must all absolutely work together to first of all shine a light on that type of xenophobia. And that's not just in Britain. That is happening all across Europe. That is happening all across the world, from where I'm sitting to where you are to where your listeners are sitting. It is for everyone who comes from a minority community, everyone who is a statistic or a sociological anomaly. We are always at risk because we have to look over our shoulder as second-class citizens. And I absolutely fundamentally reject that, because living in Europe, being European, we are taught that the fundamentals of our societies and our communities are our rights, are our freedoms, and our values. And values is what we should lead with.
Definitely. And, you know, we hear a strong message here. We can say that you have a mission to counter violent extremists because of what you went through, these attacks that you witnessed, and you started doing it very early. And you mentioned also that you were attacked because of this. You received threats, sometimes also directly to your family and at home. So how was this? How did you deal with this?
You raise an important point, and what I will say is, from witnessing the attacks and the school that I was in, which was 99% from that community, which is British Bengali, majority of the girls are Muslim, I heard the sirens. I could not understand why there were so many sirens at 8:30 in the morning, and that's because they were rushing to the bomb site. And we were evacuated because the school was an evacuation shelter. So that's why this is a very personal cause of mine. That radicalized me in a very good way. I could have chosen violence, or I could have chosen peace. I chose the path to peace because I had support from my family. However, when you become an activist and you start working for the Kofi Annan Foundation, it brings you a lot of attention. The good attention, but also the bad attention. The more you work to de-radicalize women, the more you work to disrupt extremist narratives, and the more you push them to the outskirts of the community and towards, a legal justice system where they will pay for their crimes, they start to target you personally. And those operational risks, nobody told me. Nobody told me, this. Here's the blueprint for being an activist. Here's the guide. This is what you should do and this is what you shouldn't do. I was figuring it out by myself. I was very fortunate to be mentored and guided by Mr. Annan. But, you know, he was a 70-year-old man who had the world of support. As far as I know, he had no critics. I'm an activist from East London trying to build bridges between communities who were attacking one another. And I was exposing myself. So the more work I did, the more impact I had, the more people I de-radicalized, and the more people I advocated for, the more the white supremacists and even the Islamist extremists started to attack me. They, whether that's online and offline, they spread slander about me, malicious communications, death threats. And it's not just in the UK. I'm talking about globally, people targeting me because I was disrupting the work of, Daesh, so to speak. I was being a disruptive force in their recruitment and their terrorist campaigns. And that culminated in me being very afraid. That culminated in me thinking, I have to stop. And there was a moment when it all hit its peak. I can't do this anymore. I don't want to, they will attack me. They will find me on the street or they will hurt my family. And I remember having a conversation with a friend saying, this is really difficult. I don't know if I can continue because I'm at risk and I can't expose myself, but I want to do this good work. And so you ask yourself that question is, have I done enough and do I need to stop? And my friend simply, in a tough love sort of way, said, you chose this life. There's no going back now. And what he meant by that was, you knew the risks, you know the benefits, and you know yourself. So you have to be resilient. And doing good is a lonely path. And I think I was telling you this the other day, it is a long and lonely path. So if you want to achieve peace, you have to hang in there. And of course, don't be, I took the professional security advices that were given to me by our foundation and the, law enforcement services, and taking a step back, but ultimately remembering I am resilient. And if you're doing good work, it will undoubtedly attract people who want to stifle that good work. So it's been tough. It still happens, but I'm absolutely more resilient. I try not to engage with it. I try not to, I try and ignore it. And if it gets too much, well, ultimately my silence is far more powerful than any of the slander they can throw at me.
Exactly. It's the best reply that you can give to them, right? And you also say something super important, which is the fact that when I was also told this when I started being attacked by hundreds of people after my award, it was like people told me, it means that you're doing the right thing because you bother them, right? So of course it's scary. Of course you need to take, precautions. But it means that what you do has having an impact.
I should actually tell you a funny story, Yasmin. The week before I started, I got my first ever death threat. I made a throwaway comment in conversation saying to my friend, well, darling, if you're not getting death threats, you're clearly not doing a good enough job. And I kid you not, the very next week, it's like I spoke it into existence. It's like, the more you do, the better you are, the more the terrorists or the racists or the xenophobes will want to attack you personally because they want to shut you down. So you just have to ignore it and continue to do what you're doing at an accelerated pace and scale. And ultimately, there are more people who will support you than be against you.
Yes. And also, I'm very, very, very happy and lucky to have, you know, other activists supporting me, and I can count you among them, because
absolutely,
first time we met, you were already giving me lessons and giving me advices on Yasmin security. Yasmin, like, remember that the minute you told me this, I will never forget. Yasmin, the minute you're out there, you're being exposed, so you need to be careful of you or your family.
And that was because of my lived experiences. Like I said, Yasmin, nobody held my hand. Nobody gave me a guidebook to being an activist. There was no support. It was trial by error, you know, doing things and hoping it would have impact, but not realizing the personal impact it would have. And so obviously when we met, I saw your spark and of course think you're brilliant. And so I want to protect you from that as much as possible. And by extension, many other young Muslim women who are traversing very dangerous paths, because you need to keep going. My dear sisters, you need to work hard, but you just know that there are other women who will support you and guide you through this process.
Thank you. Thank you. And I think many people listening to us will, you know, take these and feel more, you know, surrounded by a community of women supporting them. At least they got our back, I think. And so,
oh, absolutely.
Amazing. You were also mentioning something crucial of your career, which is the fact that you were selected by Kofi Annan, the Kofi Annan Foundation, to be part of a program called Extremely Together to counter violent extremism. How was it? Like, was it expected? Did you apply? How did you receive it? How was it also when you met him for the first time?
The Kofi chapter of my life, or the Kofi years of my life, are really, really important and significant. So I had been working at the local level in the UK, on the ground, in the front lines of countering violent extremism for about 5 years, three to 5 years before that. And there was a global call from Kofi Annan to say, we realize violent extremism is a global problem. We recognize that young people are disproportionately affected by violent extremism, both as perpetrators and as victims. And the victims part really resonated, because I wasn't a physical victim, but I can absolutely tell you I was an emotional victim of the 7/7 bombings. The vicarious trauma that I carried around, and the guilt and then having that shape me, was something that has carried me to this point. And I thought, it's Kofi Annan. Oh my God, this is the man that I admire, I adore. He is the Secretary General of the United Nations. He was opposed against the Iraq War. You know, he had values and he had ethics and morals in a time when we were world leaders did not have any of those things. And I'm sure you'll recall, you know, we were entering into world wars, not world wars, pardon me. We were entering into wars that not necessarily had to be fought. Diplomatic efforts could have been followed. And so Kofi Annan was definitely the voice of reason, and he had been a guiding light for me through his words. And I thought, here, what the hell? Let's just do it. I have nothing to lose. And if I don't get it, I might just be a statistic. And if I do get it, then buckle up, people, because this statistic, quotation marks, has got a lot to offer this world. And so I applied, and actually I found out I was the last person to apply. Like, I really cut it at the final, because I was working and there was so much going on that I had to, you know, do my application at like midnight or something. And then you get a call. Mr. Annan would like to meet you. He would like to invite you to Geneva. And he wants you to help co-found an initiative called Extremely Together for young people, by young people. So myself and 9 other amazingly talented activists came together to create an initiative aimed at countering violent extremism globally by empowering youth, using our resources and our lived experiences of being witnesses or survivors or people who have been touched by this in a unique way, to expand it out to our communities. And what was unique about us is not because we had the backing of an international figurehead and his political will, which was absolutely integral and helpful, but because it was 10 people from 10 different parts of the world, one mission and the same goals. And it was beautiful and it was brilliant. And I'm glad to say, since 2016 to now, we have gone from success to success, and we continue to complete Kofi Annan's mission and be his legacy.
Exactly, exactly. Because let's remind, you know, he passed away in 2018. And by the way, like, I think it's my biggest regret not meeting him before, because just for you to know, I met your colleague, Hajar Sharif, who is also an extremely together fellow. And then I discovered your profile. I got in touch with you. But before that, just before that, I contacted the Kofi Annan Foundation because I was so interested in this program. And I wanted, like, I was dreaming of meeting him. And a few months after he passed away, unfortunately, they replied to me. I was in contact with them. But yeah, he passed away.
I know. It's like the lights went out in the world. I have to say, first of all, Hajar is brilliant. And she's another brilliant activist from the MENA region doing amazing things. When Kofi Annan passed away in 2018, it was sadness on a level I had never felt before, because it was my mentor, my guide, the first person to have believed in me. And this was a loss for the whole world. So like you felt it, I felt it, everybody felt it, because we realized as the tide was turning, as xenophobia and nationalism and far-right extremism was on the rise, the one guiding force and the one guiding voice that we all looked up to had suddenly been taken from us. Prematurely, I should add, because I know he had so much more to give and we had so many more things planned together, but I will always remember what he said to me. He would always say to me, "Fatima, you are never too young to lead." And he would then add, "I, as in Kofi, I'm never too old to learn." So that was his parting wisdom, and I will carry that forward. And I will go on to tell others that you are never too young to lead.
Such a humble person. And I'm glad to see that, you know, the Kofi Annan Foundation continues. The Extremely Together program continues to run. You are reaching many countries in the world, schools where you train young people. So it's keeping going.
Yeah, I will do a shameless plug, Yasmin. I'm so sorry. I'm very proud to say that despite the current challenges, we have just launched our local chapters in Pakistan, in the Philippines, and we already have Somalia and Uganda. So if you are in any of those countries or in any of those regions, you have a home within Extremely Together. So whether you are an activist, a peace builder, or someone who needs support, Extremely Together will be there for you, because we're present in all these different countries and all these different regions. And just because we can't get on a plane does not mean we cannot digitally connect.
Exactly, exactly. Nothing prevents us from continuing to do our work, and especially on those times of crisis. You mentioned that, you know, he was the first one to believe in you, but he was not far from being the last one, because after that you were recognized for your work by the Asian community. So do you want to tell more about it? I was very happy to see this.
Thank you so much. I'll briefly touch on it, because I do get slightly embarrassed. Countering violent extremism is not a glamorous job. It's not sexy. Being an activist is not.
Especially as a woman, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, we talked about structural inequalities, and these are most apparent when you are in the front line of a peace building type of role. It's very challenging on every day, and nobody recognizes you. And so I got my recognition and was invited to join the Kofi Annan Foundation, which was great. And I was content, because finally it was many years of hard work paying off. But then the recognition continued to come, and the more impact. And as I was saying to you, Yasmin, community is very important to me. And so in 2017, I was awarded the Asian Women of Achievement in the UK, which was very surprising, because in the 18-year history of the awards, at that point, I was the youngest person to receive that. It was the validation I needed. It was almost vindication. It was, "We are proud of what you're doing. Please continue to work. And irrespective of whoever wants to harm you, your community, the South Asian community, is behind you." And that just empowered me and motivated me to take my work to the next level, to a more internationally scalable sort of way. And so we globalized Extremely Together further, you know, and that's where the chapters came from. That's where the Extremely Together roadshow came from, which we went to the Middle East, we went to Africa, we went to Latin America, we went to North America and Europe. To make sure we were touring and supporting communities who needed us, and that was at the request of those communities, and it was an absolute privilege to be able to do that and to continue to do that, and share stories across borders.
Exactly, and as you said, you went all of a sudden international, but it was a need for you to also, you know, keep your feet in your own community and be like, look, what I do can speak to you too. And so the minute you were recognized, I think it was such an important step for you also as a woman, because often I imagine that you would open doors, enter in a room for a meeting and being the only woman at the front line, right?
I can't tell you. I mean, it still happens. It was very awkward. In the process of my career, and I actually haven't really spoken about this publicly because I have a rule of negativity will not become the signifier of my work. It will only be positivity. But, you know, at the age of 22, I had men trying to destroy me because they did not think a woman should be in the CVE field. They were stealing my resume. They were calling people to say, do not employ her, do not give her a space in your community center, close the doors on her. And this was a targeted and coordinated campaign by what I will say weak men wanting to do this. And I was aware of the sexism, and you know, my mother made me a fiery woman. You know, she's a fiery woman herself. So I was ready to fight, but it has been fight consistently. And then once you open that door, because Kofi Annan gives you a seat at his table, what you don't realize is that there are other women, non-POC women, who want to then diminish your work, who want to destroy you. And it was really upsetting because for me, women should band together and sisterhood and community, that's what it's all about. But then when you know, just before I was recruited by Kofi Annan, I was experiencing so much racism from women who are in positions of authority or who are my peers, but felt the need to demean and degrade a lot of the work that I was doing because it was having that impact. For some reason, I cannot understand why. Now that I do a post-mortem of it, it's that they were insecure and they felt threatened by a brown woman coming in and being as good as them. And for me, it was, I'm sorry, I will not be a statistic just because you need to feel comfortable. I refuse to lessen my shine and lessen my brightness just because you need to shine brighter. Absolutely not. Together, we should be conquering the world. And it took me a long time to learn that. So as you say, as one door opens and the more progress you make, there is still another blockade. So you have to continue to chip away at it. And the more doors you open, it is absolutely important. And you know, one of my personal values, to bring others with you.
Exactly. You know, it's a constant struggle and it's a responsibility when you open that door to make other women enter. And, you know, I think that people attacking you or people, you know, being just jealous of your work, it's because you're not a token and you're not a statistic, in the sense that you're not, you know, you stood up, but you're not just there to be like, look, I'm the woman with Asian backgrounds talking. No, you also have a brilliant discourse and ideas that disrupt the status quo.
Exactly. And people try and put you down. And this experience can extract out to everyone who's from a minority ethnic background or has some sort of protected characteristic or diversity. And these microcosms of people wanting to degrade you and demean you is no less different to a violent extremist wanting to attack you based on your skin color or your religion, because ultimately what extremism is a violent denial of diversity. So it might start as a throwaway comment or someone mispronouncing your name or appropriating your culture, but the truest extent of it is that it could lead to violent conflict, and that's on the same spectrum. So what we need to do is be very, very clear about recognizing people for their merit and not for their skin color. You know, I'm sick and tired of going into rooms where I am the only expert who is a woman. I am the only expert who is a person of color. And I am also the only expert who's the youngest. And for a long time, I would go away from these meetings or these consultations and think about this to myself. And actually, earlier this year, I thought, I'm not going to think about it. What I will now start doing is I will walk into that room and the first thing I will say is I'm appalled and I'm disgusted that there is only white men or white women in this room. It's not right. You cannot be talking about the future of people's lives without having them be represented.
Yeah, and you arrived at a point where you feel comfortable to do it and to say it. And also your ideas, your discourse is backed by findings, convictions that are, you know, based on academic studies. You have a master's degree in security studies. You also were selected as an Obama scholar to join the cohort that for a year was mentored by Barack Obama himself. And you could also meet Michelle Obama. How was that? Tell us.
Oh my God. Again, so just when you think life is so good to you and you finally stopped being a statistic, it's almost like, no, I have better plans for you. You know, God has more plans for you. And again, in 2018, as part of President Obama's post-presidential legacy, he is all about building community and building young leaders to lead today for tomorrow. And there was an opportunity from his foundation to form part of the inaugural class of Obama scholars. And what I will say is 2 years prior, the first time I had met President Obama was in 2016 when he came to the UK on his last presidential visit. And it was, you will know this because it was the famous back of the queue speech. Essentially, if you vote Brexit, you will be at the back of the queue. And that's why I remember it, because I wanted to hear what President Obama had to say. And I love the man because he represented the breath of hope and change and everything in the world when it was all dire. And so I had the opportunity to meet with him, and I made a throwaway comment saying, one day, President Obama, I will work for you. And it was almost cheeky to say, like, who do I think I am? But why not? You know, speak it into existence. And then 2 years later, I remember sitting with Kofi and saying, there's an opportunity. It's about, I want to develop myself further so that I can continue to make sure that we make progress in the work that we are doing. How would you feel about that? And he said, I will never hold you back. And in fact, I want you to do this. And when they met in Johannesburg, Kofi Annan actually said to Barack Obama, I'm giving you one of my best. So, but again, this was all it's all a chance that you take, right? Many people apply. I mean, I think there are like 20,000 applications for the Obama programs. But then I get a call saying, we would like to invite you to form part of the inaugural class of Obama scholars.
Amazing.
And that's the reaction you have. My reaction was, oh no, what have I done? Because I was so scared. This is Barack Obama. This is Michelle Obama. They are the, you know, at this moment in time, they are the most positive influences in the world. And, you know, they represent so much for people of color who went from being a statistic to being in the White House. So it spoke so much to my own personal story. And then I got on a plane, I packed up my stuff and I moved to the US and met amazing other people. And it was magic. It was learning from President Michelle Obama, their values, the way they lead and how to tackle issues facing young people at a global scale. And I'm very grateful, because not only was that a personal achievement, but it was, look what the daughter of migrants to the UK can do. Look what the daughter of immigrants has achieved. So it wasn't a win for me. It was a win for my parents. It was a win for our community. And it was never, ever, ever call anyone a statistic, because you never know what their future holds. And this is not, you know, I'm sharing this because I want other young people who are listening to this podcast, who are feeling like statistics at this very moment, to know that this feeling is not it doesn't last, because what you can achieve and the potential you have is awaiting being unlocked. So go in search of those who will invest in you and give you their time, because when they see young people who have ideas and who want to make a change and have this urgency, they will fundamentally and absolutely invest their time, resources and money in you, and you will then be able to contribute to public service.
Exactly. And, you know, that's precisely one of the missions that we have at We Belong, because for every episode at the end, we share one opportunity. And it's also to say that, yes, everybody can try. And that's because you dared and you tried.
Yep. You just have to dare.
It's also because you're amazing. But no, you know.
Thank you, Jasmine. You're far too kind. No, honestly, sometimes you just have to say, yes, I am brown. Yes, I'm a Muslim. Yes, I'm a woman. So what?
Exactly. And also taking it ironically. Let's conclude, Fatima. I would ask you, you know, a key for the people listening to us. You gave so many keys. You gave already so many keys. But if there was one that you want to share to young women with, you know, immigrants or underprivileged background that would not maybe have this, you know, courage to dare, what do you tell them?
Oh, this is the perfect question. And I'm so glad you've asked me this, Yasmin. In and amongst everything that I've said, I have one main thing. Be unapologetic. Do not apologize for your skin color. Do not apologize for your race. Do not apologize for your culture. And do not apologize for other people's inability to see how brilliant you are and other people's small-mindedness. Because you are brilliant and you have so much to give to the world. So be unapologetic.
Thank you. Unapologetic. We will remember this and we will remember that we can all do it. And that's what Obama teach us, right? Yes, we can.
Yes, we can.
Thank you so much, Fatima. It was such a pleasure talking to you. And yeah, thank you. I hope to see you soon.
Thank you so much, Yasmin. The pleasure's been mine and we'll definitely catch up soon.
To conclude, my key for today is the Obama Foundation Scholarships, a program that Fatima Zeman could benefit from. You can find all the information on obama.org and check on the deadlines, the application process, and how to become a volunteer, a scholar, or a fellow at the Obama Foundation. This was the end of our episode. You are listening to We Belong, which is a podcast produced by Le Cavalcade, and you can find us on all platforms. Bye!